Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. Today we have two interesting stories for you. First, we will remember the end of World War II as we look back 70 years. Some Japanese Americans will share their memories with us. Then some technology news that could save the lives of jet pilots as they fly very fast and very high above us. Let's get ready to listen and learn with part one. This year marks the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Recently, several Japanese-American men gathered in Los Angeles to remember the events of 70 years ago. All the men were veterans. They served in the U.S. Armed Forces or did other work for the government during the war. At the same time, their families were held in internment centers in the United States. Christopher Jones Cruz takes the story from there.
The Japanese-American veterans met recently in the Little Tokyo neighborhood of Los Angeles. They served in the U.S. Army's Combat, Construction, and Intelligence units. They served the country while their families were being held in camps on the West Coast. 60% of those detained were U.S. citizens. The families were not released until the war ended. Yoshio Nakamura was one of the veterans at the gathering. He says he always believed that one day people would understand that the detentions were illegal. He says he and other Japanese Americans fought proudly for their country.
And I also felt very strongly that we needed to show that we were patriotic Americans.
In 1988, President Ronald Reagan and the U.S. government apologized for forcing Japanese Americans to live in the camps. Bill Seki leads the education center where the gathering took place. He says Japanese American soldiers fought honorably and well.
And through their battles as a segregated unit, they ended up becoming the most decorated unit in Army history for their size and duration.
Many of the veterans at the gathering took part in heavy fighting. Tokuji Yoshihashi was in the mostly Japanese-American 100th Infantry Battalion. That unit helped defeat German forces in northern Italy. Their efforts were described in a U.S. government film made during the war.
Important and decisive battles. And each time, these men of the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Combat Team have been right out in front.
Mr. Yoshihashi remembers the fighting in northern Italy.
The most beautiful sight I ever saw was four P-47s come in, and they rocketed and machine-gunned the German position, and that kind of helped us break through.
Some Japanese Americans had family members who served in the U.S. military and others who fought for Japan. Ken Akune and his older brother served in the U.S. Army. Two of his younger brothers were from Japan and belonged to the Japanese military. He knew he could meet one of them in battle.
What would you do if you met him in the field and he's got the gun for you? You know, at that point you start to think, well, you know, it's a means of survival, you know. But the point is, I never let that thing bother me at all.
After the war, the brothers met in Japan.
And they stood up, and we stood up, and we were ready to go at it. But my dad was there and said, hey, the war is over. Forget it, you know. So after the time, we never talked about it.
Many veterans lost good friends in the war. Their names are written on a monument at the Education Center. The monument has meaning to veteran Don Miyada.
It signifies to me the sacrifices of many good men.
He says the marker and gatherings of veterans will help keep their sacrifices from being forgotten. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. While flying high above Earth's surface, jet fighter pilots may suffer loss of eyesight for brief periods. Some pilots may even lose consciousness, not being able to recognize what is happening around them. These experiences, commonly called blackouts, can lead to tragic results. Now, an Israeli company says it has developed a device that could save pilots' lives at such times. Jonathan Evans has more.
Yaron Krantz is Senior Research and Development Director at Elbit Systems. He is also a retired fighter pilot. He says two different situations can lead to a pilot's loss of consciousness.
One is GLOC, or G, loss of consciousness, and the other one is hypoxia, which is lack of oxygen to the brain.
GLOC happens when the airplane is making a sharp turn or speeding up very quickly. During these periods, centrifugal force reduces the normal flow of blood to the pilot's brain. At high speeds, loss of control of the aircraft has proved deadly for many pilots. Hypoxia, or lack of oxygen, can affect anyone at extreme heights. That is why passenger planes are equipped with oxygen masks. Passengers are always told before flying to put on the masks in case of a sudden loss of air pressure. Current devices for preventing such dangerous situations are very large. So Elbit Systems and a small startup company called LifeBeam developed a system they are calling Canary. It uses small, non-invasive sensing equipment. Yaron Krantz says the sensors are built into the helmet worn by the pilot.
The pilot doesn't have to do anything in order to activate those sensors, and they are small enough and wise enough to give the information to gather the physiological data that is required.
By physiological data, he means information related to the processes and activities that keep the person alive. When the danger is real, the system sends a message to the visor on the front of the helmet. If it senses that the pilot has lost consciousness, it tells the plane's computer to activate the autopilot. The autopilot will then take control of the plane's movement until the pilot wakes up. Elbit Systems is now developing its Canary device for U.S. F-35 fighter jets and other aircraft. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to As It Is from the Learning English Department at the Voice of America, Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The World Health Organization says the use of surgical childbirth is growing worldwide. Surgical childbirth is when a woman gives birth with the help of a surgical operation, also called a cesarean section. WHO officials say the operation is becoming especially popular in what they call high and middle-income countries. Doctors may advise a cesarean birth, known as a C-section, when normal childbirth would put the health of the mother or the baby at risk. But the United Nations agency says it is concerned about the possible abuse of this life-saving surgery. The World Health Organization is a strong supporter of cesarean sections when they are justified medically. The WHO notes that such operations can save lives, but it says mothers and their babies are put at risk of health problems when a cesarean section is performed without a medical need. Since 1985, health experts have set what they call the ideal rate for C-sections at between 10 and 15% of all births. New studies show when rates go below 10%, more mothers and babies die because they are unable to get this life-saving treatment. These findings are confirmed by estimates from Africa. They show a link between low C-section numbers and high mortality rates during childbirth. Yet studies show there is no evidence that death rates improve when the rate rises above 10%. In fact, cesarean sections sometimes can have serious effects on the mother and her child. Marlene Temmerman is the director of the WHO's Department of Reproductive Health and Research. She told VOA that a C-section is generally a safe operation, but she adds, health risks do exist. Dr. Temmerman says a C-section is advisable when a traditional vaginal delivery puts the mother or baby in danger. Dr. Temmerman is concerned about the increase in the number of unnecessary cesarean sections being performed in both developed and developing countries. She says changing opinions and other lifestyle issues generally are the reason for what she calls an epidemic of C-sections. These operations, she adds, are easier for gynecologists and hospitals. She says C-sections help doctors to get more control of day-to-day planning. With cesareans, there are no calls in the middle of the night and no emergencies. Dr. Temmerman says C-sections are also better for hospitals because they are able to organize their workforce. As for the women, she says many choose a C-section over a vaginal birth because they do not want the pain of childbirth or may be afraid of the physical after effects. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that in 2013, the percentage of all U.S. births by C-section was 32.7%. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we begin the story of Bill Clinton, America's 42nd president. He led the United States for 8 years, from January of 1993 to January of 2001. Our story begins in 1991. In February of that year, American-led forces won Operation Desert Storm to end Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein considered Kuwait a province of Iraq. He had invaded the oil-rich country in August 1990. Coalition airstrikes began 4 months later in January against Iraqi targets. The ground war took place in February and lasted just 4 days. The American-led victory in the Gulf War added to the popularity of President George H.W. Bush. 1991 was also the last year for the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The collapse of the Soviet Union brought an end to more than 40 years of Cold War tensions and fears of nuclear war. In the United States, attention was turning to the 1992 presidential election. Many political observers believed President Bush would easily win a second term. But the economy was not doing much to help his chances. The United States went through a serious recession that lasted 8 months, from July 1990 to March 1991. Unemployment rose to the highest level in years. At the same time, the federal government was deeply in debt after years of borrowing. Bush was a Republican. Democrats saw his falling popularity as a good opportunity to retake the White House. They placed their hopes on William Jefferson Clinton. At the time, he was the young governor of the southern state of Arkansas. He was gaining national attention by talking about issues like education. Bill Clinton was born on August 19, 1946, in the small town of Hope, Arkansas. His name at birth was William Jefferson Blythe. His father, also named William Jefferson Blythe, was a traveling salesman. He died in a car accident 3 months before his son was born. At the age of two, the boy was sent to live with his grandparents, while his mother, Virginia Blythe, studied to become a nurse. She married a man named Roger Clinton when her son was four. The family moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas. When he was 15, William Jefferson Blythe legally changed his name to William Jefferson Clinton. His stepfather drank too much and was sometimes abusive to him, his mother, and his stepbrother, Roger Jr. But Bill Clinton did well in school. He also developed a strong early interest in politics and ran for student offices in high school. In 1963, while still in high school, Bill Clinton went to Washington as a delegate to a Boys Nation program for young leaders. There, he got to meet President John F. Kennedy. Years later, Richard Stratton, who was president of Boys Nation in 1963, remembered that meeting.
It was a beautiful, bright summer day. It was July 24, 1963. And we were all assembled in the Rose Garden at the White House as a group, waiting for the president to come out.
We want to welcome you to the White House, particularly because this belongs to all of you and because it's so intimately connected with the best in American history.
I was about the third or fourth person in, and I sort of muscled my way up and made sure I got to shake hands with the president.
Right after that famous frame of him shaking hands with JFK, there's another picture showing President Kennedy shaking hands with another one of our boys, and Bill Clinton looking down at his hand with this wonderful look like I'll never wash it again.
Bill Clinton went on to study at Georgetown University in Washington. He graduated in 1968 and won a Rhodes Scholarship to attend Oxford University in England. He spent 2 years there before entering Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut. There, he met another law student, Hillary Rodham. She was from just outside Chicago, and she shared his deep interest in politics and public service. They both graduated in 1973. Bill Clinton returned to Arkansas. Hillary Rodham went on to become a lawyer involved in the congressional investigation of the Watergate scandal. That case led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon in 1974. That same year, Bill Clinton, a Democrat, ran for Congress in Arkansas. He lost the close race to a popular Republican. A year later, he and Hillary Rodham married. And a year after that, in 1976, Arkansas voters elected him Attorney General, the state's top law enforcement officer. In 1978, Bill Clinton ran for governor and easily won. He became, at the age of 32, the state's youngest governor ever. While Bill Clinton was governor, the federal government operated a detention center in Arkansas for Cuban refugees. The refugees rioted. That rioting hurt Bill Clinton politically when he ran for re-election. His opponent argued that he should have done more to get the government to hold the Cubans someplace else. Also, Clinton had supported unpopular new taxes. In 1980, Bill Clinton was defeated in his campaign for a second term as governor of Arkansas. But he regained the office in the next election 2 years later. Clinton went on to serve as governor of Arkansas until 1992. While he was governor, education in the state improved. More students finished high school, and more went on to college. The state increased requirements for teachers and also increased their pay. Governor Clinton also expanded early learning programs for children from poor families. While governor, Bill Clinton also became active in Democratic Party leadership at the national level.
Make no mistake, this election is about change. Change in our party, change in our leadership, change in our nation. And that is why today I proudly announce my candidacy for President of the United States of America.
In 1991, Bill Clinton announced that he would run for the Democratic nomination for president. His main opponents were Paul Tsongas and Jerry Brown. Tsongas was a former senator from Massachusetts. Brown had been governor of California. Paul Tsongas later withdrew, and Bill Clinton easily defeated Jerry Brown for the nomination. Democrats held their national nominating convention in New York City in July 1992.
In the name of all those who do the work, pay the taxes, raise the kids, and play by the rules, in the name of the hardworking Americans who make up our forgotten middle class, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Bill Clinton chose Senator Al Gore of Tennessee as his running mate for vice president. The Republicans nominated President Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle for a second term. Another candidate in the 1992 presidential election was a Texas businessman named Ross Perot. he competed as an independent, a so-called third-party candidate. His choice for vice president was James Stockdale, a former high-level Navy officer and pilot. During the campaign, Ross Perot argued that neither of the major candidates was taking the national debt seriously enough. He also warned of the loss of American jobs.
To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element in making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Bill Clinton criticized President Bush for not doing more about the economy and unemployment. Bush pointed out that the Democrats controlled Congress, and he said the Democrats had defeated most of his proposals. The president also talked about his foreign policy successes, and most famously, he promised not to raise taxes.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say, read my lips. No new taxes.
But raise taxes he did, and many Americans remembered that on Election Day. Bill Clinton and Al Gore won the 1992 election. They received about 45 million votes, or 6 million more than President Bush and Vice President Quayle. Ross Perot and James Stockdale received close to 20 million, or 19% of the popular vote. Bill Clinton became America's 42nd president on January 20th, 1993. At the age of 46, he was the third youngest person ever elected president. At his inauguration, the new president said there was no longer a division between foreign and domestic issues.
The world economy, the world environment, the world AIDS crisis, the world arms race, they affect us all. Today, as an old order passes, the new world is more free but less stable. Communism's collapse has called forth old animosities and new dangers. Clearly, America must continue to lead the world we did so much to make.
But even as he took office, critics were questioning Clinton's character. There had been accusations during the campaign about relationships with other women in Arkansas. And there were questions about an investment that he and Hillary Clinton had made in a land development project back in 1978. President Clinton's first term in office will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.